Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Sharon Tucker. Our speaker this afternoon is Carrie Miles. She received her Ph.D. in Social and Organizational Psychology, University of Chicago. Her Bachelor of Science in Psychology at BYU. Currently, she is the training coordinator at Lockheed Missiles and Space Company since 1984 to present at the Santa Clara University, adjunct lecturer. She has co-authored pieces on research methodology, she has organized self-help groups for widows, and a piece on LDS Children Church Reaction to Changing Women's Roles, to be presented at the conference of the American Sociological Association this summer. She is married to L.R. Giannacone and has two children. Her paper is The Friend, a Content Analysis. The response will be given by Levina Fielding Anderson, who is currently the president of Editing Incorporated. She has been the associate editor and co-associate editor of Dialogue. She is married and has one son.
I'm going to be talking about a content analysis that I did of The Friend, or for those of you who are as old as I am, it's still The Children's Friend to me. It will always be The Children's Friend to me. But first I'd like to do a little exercise to illustrate one of the basic premises that underlies content analysis, and I'd like to get you involved in this. What I'm going to do is tell you about a type of article that you might find if you walked out here onto the mall and went up to a newsstand and just kind of thumbed through some magazines. And I'd like you to tell me what kind of magazine or what magazine you might expect to find that kind of article in. Okay? You want to play? Okay. An article about how the changing smoking habits has affected the economy of the South. What kind of magazine would you expect to find that kind of article in?
A news magazine. Forbes Business Magazine.
Okay, great. I happened to read that in Business Week, actually. How about an article about a couple who go to a marriage counselor and save their marriage? What kind of magazine? A woman's magazine. Okay, good. An article on the Rams' decision to move to Irwindale.
Sports Illustrated.
Okay. And you have a girl in a bathing suit on the cover. All right. An inspirational piece about a boy who loses both of his legs and goes on to bicycle across the country for charity. No doubt at all about that one. An article on how our foreign policy has hurt the domestic economy.
The nation.
Okay. And would Atlantic Monthly give you a different kind of perspective than, say, the New Republic would? All right. Tips on how to use Alka-Seltzer to spice up your sex life.
The National Enquirer.
Okay. Maybe Cosmo. Okay. A story about how home teachers kept a rebellious teenager from dropping out of high school. Good, okay. The point here is that different magazines have different things that they're trying to accomplish. Okay. Different values that underlie what it is that their purpose is. Okay. And some do that very explicitly, and on the masthead it says, dedicated to liberal politics or conservative politics or whatever it is. Okay, some are not very explicit about what their agenda is, and some are not even very profound. For instance, Decorating and Craft Ideas does have an editorial policy, and it does have particular values that underlie it, but who cares? Okay, they must, yeah. If you look at one story in those magazines, the values and goals of the writer editor may not be very explicit if you just look at one, but if you look at them, you know, look at them systematically or over time, you can begin to figure out what those values are, what it is that they're trying to do. And sometimes those values are unarticulated. They would have a hard time telling you what those values are exactly, but they still come through in the writing. And that's not only true in written messages, but also in our verbal messages, too. It's just those are more difficult to capture and analyze. Those values do show. The church publications are particularly nice for doing content analyses because their purpose is to teach us. And we are periodically admonished to treat the publications. Is this one on? Okay. As scripture. And they're trying to. Thank you. Trying to teach us things. And this is also true of the Children's Friend. And let me read you a quote from one of the editors of the Children's Friend in this regard. There are seldom tidy resolutions in life, and we need to give children courage and encouragement as they meet the unresolved situations in their own lives. The gospel is the anchor. Our challenge is to present it realistically enough that it meets the needs of those in conflict with it while reinforcing the values of stable homes. So teaching values is part of what the Children's Friend is about. It's not just an alternative to Jack and Jill. The church isn't going to the trouble to publish it just to entertain us. So I looked at the Children's Friend for what it was saying to us on a number of different topics. And these topics were values about the work success ethic or need for achievement, at attitude towards ethnic groups and the internationalization of the church, at attitudes towards blacks, and at what we're being taught as appropriate sex roles. And I'd like to share with you what I found on each one of those topics. Let's start with the work success ethic. The work success ethic is a very common topic for content analysis. David McClellan and his Need for Achievement at Harvard made that very popular among psychologists. And as Getzels describes the motive, it means that values of achievement take precedence over other kinds of values. And the notion is that anyone can get to the top if they try hard enough, and that we have an obligation to try to get to the top. That's what that value is. And the work success ethic glorifies work for its own sake. You might also hear it referred to as the Protestant ethic or the spirit of capitalism or need for achievement. Getting to the top implies an implicit or explicit competition, maybe against other people or against some kind of standard of excellence. You're trying to do the best there is. Okay, and entrepreneurs and successful business people are generally high in this particular value or motive. And academics and artists and those of us who'll never make any money tend to be low on this particular motive. Well, I originally started working on this paper in a graduate class I was taking, and the man I took the class from had done some work on the achievement motive, and he had charted how it had changed back from like the 40s and 50s, where it was the Horatio Alger, boy makes good, very high in need for achievement. And then he kind of charted how that had changed over the last 40 or 50 years with the me generation and different kind of interests, self-fulfillment rather than achievement. And I didn't think that the Mormons had changed that much on the work success ethic. I couldn't see us moving over time the way Getzels was saying that society at large has. So I wanted to look at that. And what I did in this content analysis was pick three articles at random for every year between 1948 and 1987. It was 119 articles, stories altogether. I just used the stories from the Friend and looked at what they were saying about need for achievement. Now, they weren't explicitly talking about it, but it was implied in the stories. Okay. The Friend's stories overwhelmingly affirm at least part of the ethic, and that's the value of hard work. In an early example, there's a bunch of furniture up in the attic, and you remember what the Friend stories are like, right? There's a bunch of furniture up in the attic, and one of them is this flute that hasn't been touched in 20 years, and a little girl comes along and finds it, and Grandma lets her have it, and the flute is delighted at being put to work again. Okay? Hard work being useful, that's valuable. 26 years later, you're still finding this value apparent in the story, and this story was the baseball team about a Panamanian boy. And after an exhausting day, the boy finds that he's discovered the joy of work. And he says, "Is this how a man's work makes you feel, kind of full and proud inside?" And this was very consistent throughout this entire 40-year period that I looked at. The children in the Friend stories are usually portrayed as being very eager to work and to help out. Work for its own sake was very valued. Little girls took pride in being mother's big helpers. Boys dutifully shepherded their sheep, kept, you know, watch over them very conscientiously. One story is about a 5-year-old who does his father's home teaching to help out. And the father doesn't know about it, but he's trying to help. Stories about young men conscientiously working after school to pay off a family debt. Church workers and scriptural figures laboring to spread the gospel, and so forth. Okay, so work was very highly valued in these stories, and for its own sake. This makes you feel good to work hard. But work was not always the preferred activity for children. After work, that Panamanian boy's father tells him, play is good too. And the overall picture of the ideal child's activity is either working or helping and also engaging in these playful activities, working hard at that as well. The children were never, ever portrayed as watching television. If they're ever just lounging around with nothing to do, they're very busily engaged in trying to find something to do. And that usually turns out to be what the story is about. And in over half the stories, the main character is engaged in some kind of goal-related activity. Okay, but despite this praise of hard work, the articles revealed very little of that classic work success ethic. And part of why you couldn't code what was going on there as the work success ethic is that that ethic usually includes interest in competition and in being the best. And that was not in the Children's Friends articles. 12 of my total of 119 stories dealt with competition, but in all but 3, competition was repudiated. Okay, so competition, especially among, you know, between the children, was not something that was valued in these stories. Generally, in the stories that were about competition and repudiated competition, the character would set out to win a contest and then decide that something was more important to him than winning the contest. For instance, in A Sky Filled with Kites, which was published in 1986, there's a little boy, they're in a kite flying contest. And our hero is flying his kite, and it's doing beautifully, and he's winning the contest. Well, he looks over and sees his good friend, who's also flying a kite, and the good friend's about to, I don't exactly remember what it was, back off a cliff or something like that. And the hero realizes that the only way that he can save his friend is to crash his kite. I didn't say these storylines weren't contrived. So the hero crashes his kite, it gets his friend's attention, he doesn't fall off the cliff. But, of course, our hero does not win the kite-flying contest. Okay, he gave up competition in order to help his friend, and he tells the friend, you're more important to me than a kite. When was that? 79, you have a similar kind of story. It's called Space Princess, about some little girls who are in a rocket ship race around some asteroids. And, again, you have the girl who's in the lead, and she's in tight competition with another girl, and there's a third girl whose rocket ship is malfunctioning. And the two kind of heroines of the story give up the race in order to come back and help this girl who's going to be lost in space if they don't go back and help her. Okay, they go through this whole agonizing decision about whether they're going to give up winning the contest or not. But they decide that, as the character says, I thought the crown was most important, but it doesn't seem so important now. The only form of competition that was not explicitly disavowed by the characters in this story is the competition against an explicit goal of excellence, where you're trying to be the best and to accomplish this real high goal. And this form of competition accounts for the 3 stories in which the child does not decide to give up the competitiveness. Okay, and in these stories, the characters are rewarded for their acceptable work, for their excellent work. And even though this kind of competition seems to be acceptable, I've only found it in 3 out of 120 stories. So it's not a real main motivation here. Okay. Okay. So we've got the work ethic. We don't have the competition. Do we have the success ethic? In over half the stories, the main character was engaged in some kind of goal-related activity. And unless it involved that competition I just talked about, the goal was usually met. And even in the stories where the child didn't have an explicit goal, the endings are all happy. You know, if you go through them and just look at the endings, you know, the little girl gives the doll to a friend and they're all happy, or, you know, just one happy ending after another. They're rewarded for what they're doing. So if the Mormons' children literature espouses an ethic that glorifies work, it also values success and these people doing what they set out to do and being happy as well. What's interesting is that the stories rarely make explicit the connection between all that hard work and the good outcomes that they come up with. For instance, in the story A Sky Filled with Kites, the one about the little boy who crashes his kite, he wins first prize along with the winner. He gets a special award. It's not because his kite was flying the highest or the best, even though it was before he crashed it, but it's because he cares about his friend and that he saves his friend that he gets the reward. So the connection between winning the kite flying contest and the work that he did to get the kite up there, it's an ad hoc kind of connection. You wouldn't purposely teach a child that the way to win a flying contest is to crash the kite. Another example of this is found in a story from 1952, and it's about a young boy who has a horse, and the horse jumps over the fence and escapes. So the boy hunts all day long for this horse, never finds him. But at the end of the day, the horse comes back to him. Now, in a story that was high on this classic need for achievement, the boy, we'd be hearing about the boy's skills and how he learned these skills and how hard he worked in tracking down this horse, about his skillfulness in it, and then he'd find the horse at the end. This story, he looks all day very hard, doesn't find the horse. The horse comes back to him at the end of the day. The horse comes to him because he had earned the horse's love. Okay, again, there's a different kind of connectedness between the work that the people are doing and the outcomes. And these stories seem to teach a magical or spiritual kind of view of the world where purity of heart rather than the person's actions are what it is that determines the reward. So the characters are rewarded for patience, for being dutiful, compassionate, righteous, honest, or for not complaining, but they're not rewarded for their skills or special talents or for their competitive drive. Okay? So this is not the traditional work success ethic, but an entirely different set of values. They point beyond kind of the material sorts of things to a higher order of things like love and self-sacrifice. And it's these values the stories tell us that ensure success. Now, how do you react to that? Is that consistent with your experience with Mormonism, with what you know about our history? A lot of drive on working hard again. But what was it you said, why we worked hard?
To achieve.
But you said family and house. Mm-hmm. See, that's not the classic work success ethic. The classic work success ethic says, the heck with the family. I'm going to be Lee Iacocca.
It seems to me that in the last few years, it has been as well as, you know, being Mormon. Yeah.
But we pick up that as well. Yeah, my thing won't reach that far. what is it they're attributing their success to in those books?
Spiritual.
Okay, that's back with the friend kind of values that are taught there. Yeah.
The entire family the same way.
Okay. Different standard of success than a worldly kind of standard.
I was just saying I thought that there was a tension between those two sets of values, that it's like, on the one hand, we are encouraged to seek humility and follow community standards and to serve the people around us rather than ourselves. And yet at the same time, you do have Marriott and the Osmonds and people like that held up. And part of the way that tension is resolved, I think, is that we do glorify success and achievement, but we glorify it within a very narrow range of modes about which there's a very broad consensus. Marriott's a success because being a millionaire is something that almost everybody thinks is desirable. We have a shortage of people who are groundbreakers, who are successes in terms that they success who are successes by standards that they define for themselves. We feel uncomfortable about people who take that much autonomy upon themselves from the community.
Interesting point. Okay, there's some conflict here. You may want to decide whether that's what you want to teach your children, but you know that seems to be what is coming through in the friend, is that you know these other things are are more valuable. Now, if you want your children to be the next Mary Kay or Lee Iacocca, maybe they shouldn't be reading The Friend. Yeah, in the other story, the space princess, she doesn't get any reward from the prize committee, but she feels good about it. They know they've done the right thing. What I found in The Friend reminded me of was the scripture, by grace we're saved after all we can do. You work real hard, but your rewards come from your goodness of heart and you know, God or fate or whatever stepping in, which is kind of interesting. Okay, attitudes towards other nationalities. The church has long been concerned with preaching the gospel unto all the nations, but in the early phase of that, the nations used to come over here to Utah and settle. In the 60s and 70s, the church greatly increased its kind of international nature, which I believe in turn created an interest in understanding other cultures. And I'm sure you remember all of those Relief Society lessons on different cultures. Concern for cultural understanding among church members began to be reflected in the Friend stories in about the mid-60s. And six of the 21 stories from the 60s dealt with foreign cultures. And this really picked up in the 70s. In the 70s, one half of the stories that I picked out randomly and analyzed dealt with non-Americans. And the stories prior to 71 that were set in foreign countries simply worked some foreign customs and traditions into their storyline. But after 71, the stories really seemed to be trying to teach you about the foreign cultures. They would throw in Spanish words or Japanese words into the stories, really trying to teach what their customs were, and also seemed to indicate an intention to teach tolerance for the other traditions. For instance, in the March 73 issue, there were two stories about children learning to accept either their own heritage or someone else's heritage. A Danish girl living in the United States, she was ashamed of being Danish, wanted to be like everyone else, came to appreciate her differences, and that was positive. In another story, an American boy is living in England, and he's complaining about the British, and they don't use words right, and nothing's right, and he comes to appreciate the British. So they were teaching tolerance, acceptance, and educating people about other cultures very consciously, I believe, in the 70s. One interesting thing about these foreign set stories is that not all the traditions were accepted, however. And a few of the stories contain some really strong anti-traditional modernity themes. In these stories, a character, usually an older person, learns to accept the new ways. And in one such story, you have a little girl, Korean girl, who's being raised by her grandfather. And she's his only living relative. His son and his daughter-in-law were killed in the flood, and he's left with his granddaughter. And the grandfather does not think that girls are important, and this is imputed to Korean tradition, that only boys matter, that girls don't count. She wants to become a doctor, and he tells her that women are not competent to become a doctor. That's not what you do. And in the story, he comes down with appendicitis attack, and the doctor who's visiting the village happens to be a woman, and she comes and saves his life. And afterwards, whenever she comes to check him up, he pretends he's asleep while she's there, so he won't have to deal with the fact that this is a woman. But eventually, he overcomes that prejudice and accepts his granddaughter and tells her that he thinks she'll make a fine doctor. Okay. In another story, a Japanese grandfather has his American-born grandson come and visit him, and he overcomes his prejudice against the Americans. Other stories would encourage children to go to school in cultures where children wouldn't traditionally go to school, to overcome taboos and so forth. Okay, so this anti-traditional element here. Tradition that marks simple differences between cultures seem to be acceptable, and we're told about them and encouraged to accept them, but traditions that seem to be rooted in superstition or lack of tolerance for others are criticized in the stories. And if you remember back in the 70s, there was a lot of talk, maybe not in church, but among Mormons, about how much of the church was the gospel versus what had been kind of scooped up and was just American culture that we had reified as part of the church. And it's interesting to see some of these issues being worked out in the children's literature. I think that's what part of what was going on. Interestingly enough, this was really strong in the 70s to the point where, as I say, half of the articles were set in foreign cultures. In the 80s, there was only a trace of this interest. It just kind of dropped off. Only four of the 41 stories that I analyzed from the 80 were set in foreign countries, and none of them contained any modernity themes. What did increase dramatically in the 80s was the number of stories about biblical, Book of Mormon, or LDS historical characters. Before then, the magazine was really not very overtly religious. Okay, and in the 80s, you find a lot more stories about Book of Mormon characters. And I don't know if that was a trade-off or not. I'm not sure what happened to account for that change. And maybe when we get to questions, you might have some insight there that'll help me figure out what happened. Something else that I looked at was the blacks. And I originally did the first draft of this paper in 77, which was before the revelation admitting blacks to the priesthood. So I was curious to see how blacks were portrayed in this literature. And I was very surprised to find out that there were no blacks in America prior to the revelation. They were just not in there at all. With all of those stories set in foreign countries, there were never African or black kind of issues at all noted there. And I think that's just how they chose to deal with that issue, was to ignore it. And then since 78, there have been stories about blacks and you know, pictures, little black faces in the montage of children's faces on the cover, that sort of thing. But nothing before it. Okay, sex roles. This is an interesting one, and I'm almost out of time, so I'm going to have to talk fast. But up until about the mid-1970s, men and women, as represented in the Friends stories, followed what you'd call traditional American values, kind of leave it to beaver values, okay, very much what was going on in society. An example of this is found in the variable rates at which fathers versus mothers were involved with the children in the stories. In the 50s, only one story out of 21 had a father involved at all. But about 67% had women interacting with children in them. Okay, so in the 50s, not only were there no blacks in the country, there weren't any fathers either. Increased. And fathers were actively involved in their children in about 38% of the stories from this 30-year time period. Mothers as supervisors of children still predominate, however, appearing in that role about 70% of the time. Okay. As some of the stories, especially from the older period, if there was a father involved at all, they talked about him coming home from work. And there was one that I just loved. It's New Year's Day. The kids all get up with mom, and they go out and play in the snow and have snowball fights and drink hot apple cider and have a wonderful lunch. And then daddy comes home for work, and they have dinner. This is New Year's Day. He was over the office, yeah, watching the football games. Okay, so we're just really carried away with that notion of mom's home with the kids and daddy's at work and he comes home. Despite the fact that the mother is the parent more likely to be interacting with the children, if there's going to be a decision made by someone besides the child in the story, guess who made it? The father. Usually the child makes his own decisions in the story, but if there was another decision called for, it was usually the father who made it. And when the mother made a family decision, she was usually depicted as a widow. Grandmothers could make decisions, but grandfathers weren't around. And when the number of fathers involved in the stories went up in the 60s, the number of decisions made in the stories by characters other than the children also went up. Does that make sense? When there were more fathers around, they made more of the decisions. Stories from the 80s, however, tended to have both parents more equally involved in that. There was some catching up there. And more kind of counseling the children and explaining family decisions to them, and the mothers were involved in that as well. The predicament of an absent father was a surprisingly frequent element in these stories. In most of these kinds of situations, the mother is widowed or the father's away on a business trip or something like that, when some critical incident happened. And about 10%, 8% of the stories used that device in the plot. The absence of the father seemed to intensify or cause whatever crisis the child was facing in the story and forced the child to face the problem alone. And although the stories included mothers,
the women were represented as being relatively helpless in the face of the dilemma. There was also a portrayal of the mother becoming dependent on the sons to fill the father's away. For example, in a story from 1975 called Many Thanks, the story reads, "Ever since their father died at sea, Ingvolf, one of the sons, had taken charge of things at home." And thus women were subordinate not only to their husbands, but also to any sons who might take over the father's authority in his absence. Societal changes in attitudes towards impact began to show up, at least in the sample that I pulled from the friend, in about the mid-1970s. A story about the little girl who wants to be a doctor is an example of that. He wasn't concerned about her because she was only a girl. He doesn't think she's qualified to be a doctor. But after being attended by the female doctor, the grandfather changes his mind and decides that his granddaughter will be an excellent doctor. And so this notion of the equality of women makes its appearance explicitly in the literature at this point. You also have those modernity themes, those anti-traditional themes at issue here. Okay. The grandfather learns to adjust to the new ways, which consider girls to be important people, too. But even here, the grandfather's admission that the girl will make a good doctor is tinged with a sex distinction. And what he says is, "A grandson might have sat by my side for 3 days and nights, but he would never have had as gentle a hand as yours. You will be a fine doctor." Okay, so her ability to be a doctor is an extension of the traditional nurturant female role, which is interesting. But a little later in 1980, you have a little girl who sees, she's sitting outside a hospital, and she muses, "I'd like to be a nurse when I grow up, or maybe a doctor." So that's more acceptable. In the 50s and 60s, girls in the stories tended to be concerned with cleanliness, aesthetics, being helpful to other people, while the boys were concerned with adventure and climbing trees and proving their bravery, those kinds of things. Stories from the late 70s and the 80s, however, revealed a movement away from that, kind of leave it to beaver household, and more in tune with the modern notions about women. In one story, the main female character is hiking and climbing trees and riding horses. Space Princess, which was the one about little girls and rocket ships, not a traditional female sex role. And another story called Jake the Snake from last year contains the following line. The youngest sister says, "Girls don't play with snakes." Her older sister says, "I'm a girl and I play with snakes." So the younger sister overcomes their reluctance, and the two fill the house with snakes while their parents are away. Okay, so there, you know, you had very traditional kinds of things. I think mirroring the culture, 50s and 60s, part of the 70s, and the later 70s and 80s, moving towards, you know, girls can do these things too, as well as boys. And you had boys helping their sister bake cakes and things like that as well. So they were keeping up with the changing times. However, I'd like to share one more story with you. And this is from 1977. It's called Kyoko's Kite. And I'd like to invite you into the interpretation of this story. It was really a striking story, and I'm going to detail it for you. And Levina says she disagrees with my interpretation. It'll be interesting to see what you have to say here on this one. This story is about a Japanese girl named Kyoko, and she has a brother named Kenji and a mother and a father. And this year she decides that she's going to help her father and her brother prepare for the annual kite festival. And this involves building these, you know, elaborate kites and then flying them. Okay. So she does her homework and her chores so that there won't be any excuse to prevent her from participating. But her brother does not like that idea, and he scoffs at the notion of girls participating in the kite flying. Girls do not help with the kites. It's for the Oto sons and their sons, the fathers and the sons. But even though he's making fun of her, Kyoko insists that it's not a rule, and her father agrees with her. So she participates in the kite building. The brother sulks, refuses to have anything to do with it. And so, you know, Kyoko and her father build this kite together. The day before the contest, Kyoko and her father take the kite to the park to try it out. And there they meet the brother's friends. And the idea of a girl flying a kite is very amusing to them. And they laugh at her, and then they say, "Poor Kenji." Well, Kyoko is pretty ticked by all of this. And she's more determined than ever that she is going to win this kite flying contest. And she says, "I'll be the first girl to win this contest. I'll show them." And father says, "There are more important things than just showing others." And Kyoko's quite startled. And Father explains that for years the fathers and the sons have built kites and flown them together. Kyoko says, but you said it wasn't, you said I could help. And he said, well, you're right. There's no rule against it. You were right. And you should decide what's more important to you. But tell me what's more important to you, winning this kite flying contest or your brother's happiness? So Kyoko is stricken. She had never considered that she was imposing on the father-son relationship, and she knew she'd feel terrible if her brother tried to impose himself on her and her mother's flower arranging contest. So she decides to go home. And when she gets home, her brother is outside, and he laughs and taunts her. Couldn't fly the kite, huh? She's hurt, but now she understands why he's upset. She tells him simply that she's tired of kites and runs into the house to hide her tears. The story ends. Kyoko watched out of the window as her brother ran to join Ato-san, his father. It's a good kite, she said. Kenji and father will win many prizes. I know now that it does not matter if a girl or boy flies it. Father and I will do other things together. Now it's their time. Now, this story takes some of those earlier themes and kind of turns them around. How do you interpret this story? What does this mean to you? I don't have a whole lot of time left, but I'd like to hear you.
I hate it. Well, the end ruins the story for me. She has to take responsibility for her brother's problem. You know, she has to own the problem and then go home with it, while he gets to do whatever he wants to. I don't know. It just seems like it's a token ending on the story.
It just rather than the story itself, I think it's an illustration of what even the church has done with all their righteousness in perpetrating the myth that men and women are not equal. And even though we deny, perhaps, that we have fallen to cultural pressures or society pressures or current time pressures, you can see the evidence very clearly. In the blacks holding the priesthood, there's the great argument whether or not the church capitulated to public sentiment regarding the blacks holding the priesthood or whether, in fact, there was a revelation. I don't personally have any doubts about it, but I'm on the inside looking out. And in for other people perhaps analyzing these kind of stories, you can see where they would allow us some latitude to progress, but only after their input into our culture.
Good point. What's the story teaching? Like, time for one more comment. What's the story telling you, telling the children?
I think it's simply saying, I think I disagree with what's been said.
Okay.
I would like to see the story written with the girl and the mother doing the flower contest and the boy trying to get involved, and then see how we would react to that. I think she was just simply being gracious to the boy. I would be kind to someone like that myself. Without hesitating, I don't think it's a sexist issue at all.
All right. I'm sure that because there is the issue of sexism, that clouds everything that we see with this story. If it were not a thing between a boy and a girl, and can the girl do this or not, we could just zero in on the other issue, which is sometimes we do sacrifice,
yeah,
so that somebody else can get the limelight. That is the issue I would like to see the story represent, and I could see that more clearly if it were not for the sexism that's all there.
If you remember back to when I was talking about the competition, this is a classic one of those stories where they're involved in competition and the main character repudiates competition for the sake of someone else's well-being. But the turn this one takes, I think, is really distinctive, because those other children are rewarded. They're thanked by the person that they sacrificed for. They get a prize, or they feel good about it afterwards. This is the only one of these stories that I've ever read where the character ends up in tears at the end.
And she's taunted.
Now, you could imagine a different story where Kenji comes to appreciate this. What this story reminds me of is about this time period you had the courts ordering little girls to, you know, court ordering baseball teams, football teams to let little girls play. And it's sort of like saying, okay, you're equal, you can play with them, but you're going to ruin their fun. Anyway, however you want to interpret this story, and you know, I'd really be interested in hearing your interpretations are as good as mine, I think it reflects some really profound ambivalence about what was going on with sex roles at that time. And it was very
interested to see it in the coming through again in the children's literature. Yeah.
I can't resist the observation that this is all complicated by the Japanese cultural setting, and I don't know to what extent that becomes salient in stories for North American children in the press, but there's a certain authenticity to that in the Japanese setting, where the chief value is not even male supremacy or as opposed to equality, but family harmony. And that's what prevails, despite the taunting. Everybody is responsible for family harmony, and I think the value that's vindicated in that story is the maintenance of family harmony. And so it's anomalous, I guess, for us to be imposing on that story in that cultural setting interpretations that would be appropriate to a North American audience.
Yeah, I've heard that interpretation before.
Well, that's it. When it's in The Friend, I don't know. I'd be interested in knowing how that came out in the Japanese version of The Friend. I think that would be the place to tell. But is The Friend attempting to include stories that reflect other cultural values, so that when people read this in translation in those other cultures, they will have something to relate to? See, I think if we were to talk about this in a Japanese audience, we'd get quite different reactions.
Yeah.
That's just another dimension.
Carrie, we need to wrap this up to get Nevada's response.
Okay, let me just sum this up. That's a good point. But again, I want to go back to the whole kind of premise underlying the content analysis, and that is that you don't have to present values that you don't agree with in your magazine. And the Japanese have pornographic comic books, but you're not going to find an article about that in The Friend. You know? So it's a peculiar story, I think, in a lot of ways, and I don't know exactly what it means. When you look at values, one thing about the Mormon Church is that we're one of the few groups left that have values that you can pin to. You meet a Mormon, you know a lot about them right there on the first meeting. And I had a friend in graduate school who had written a novel about homosexuality and someone dealing with homosexuality in the church. And the publisher accepted it, and one of his comments was that it's hard. You need a structure for values in order to have conflict. It's kind of novel kind of conflict. And a lot of places don't have that anymore. You don't have romance in the movies anymore because there's no romantic tension. They just fall right into bed. It might be sexy, but it's not romantic. So Mormons are people with values. Sometimes we can't articulate them. Like the need for achievement, I think, would be hard to articulate beforehand. But social change or dealing with different cultures, which I think we've seen both here in the sex role things and in the ones with different countries, help make us think things through and what our values are. And I think that's healthy. And I think it's interesting that kind of working through the values is coming through in the children's literature as well as going on, of course, in the adult conversations.
Levine. As an assiduous reader of The Children's Friend and The Friend, it's a pleasure to respond to this clear and helpful paper analyzing their content over the past 47 years. I think that such analyses are enormously helpful in tracking what we've taught and whether that is, given current needs, the most important set of concepts to teach. Although any number of topics could have been the focus for analysis, I particularly appreciated Carrie's insight into the de facto separation of competition and success. I think her observation that Mormons have a work ethic and a success ethic, but not the work success ethic, is particularly helpful. I also enjoyed Carrie's analysis of the trends in presenting international characters and her analysis of sex role information in the stories. I was particularly interested in the in-depth analysis of Sherry Johnson's fine story, Kyoko's Kite. I had read that story with a great deal of interest when it appeared and remembered it well, and reread it after reading Carrie's analysis. I agree it presents a strong and unusual message. I might, however, take exception to her conclusion that, and this is a part of a paragraph of the summary analysis that Carrie didn't read to you, that Kyoko learns to keep her place even though she is equal to the boys, and that she is asked not to submit to male authority, but to acquiesce to male petulance, meaning the response of the brother. The story could also be interpreted as a near-classic representation of Carol Gilligan's thesis that American girls are socialized to relate, to connect, and to communicate, while boys are socialized to compete, to differentiate, and to detach.
The cultural setting is not American, but Japanese, as Armand very cogently pointed out. But that concept struck me on rereading. I would have no way of analyzing how valid it would be in a Japanese context. It is a complex and fascinating story, impressive in any context. As I read it through carefully in preparing for this response, however, I found myself thinking that Carey's conclusion does a disservice to the personality of the father. He seems to have had the extraordinary gift of waiting to teach his children a lesson until they were ready to learn it. I found no validation for Carey's conclusion that the brother's hurt feelings and rudeness to his sister are justified in the story. Instead, it seemed quite clear to me that the father, as patient with his son as with his daughter, was waiting until the boy was ready to learn his own lesson. I see in this story not a validation of sex role stereotypes, but of the primacy of human relationships, or family harmony, which is even a better phrase. I hope that Carey will develop this fine paper into a thorough examination of an equally fine periodical. I have never liked reading Reader's Digest versions, so it's difficult for me to believe that sampling only three stories a year can provide an adequate analysis of content, no matter what a statistician would say, and I realize that that gut feeling is probably not adequate. But for instance, the friend does have stories about divorced parents. They just didn't happen to appear in the March or November issues, and so they didn't appear in Carey's sample. I agree that it's important to establish trends, as Carey has done, but the next logical question is, why do these trends exist? What provides the motivation for altering a successful format to contain other elements? Who decides that these new elements or emphases are important, and why? What I'm suggesting is taking this paper beyond content analysis, which is basically a sociological question, into a full-scale historical analysis with complete documentation. For example, she quotes a managing editor in the introduction of her paper about presenting the gospel realistically, but she does not identify the editor, when he or she made this comment, or to whom. It makes a difference whether it was 1950 or 1980, for instance, and whether the remark were made in one of the last primary general conferences or in a telephone conversation. If this person was speaking off the record and wished to be anonymous, which is perfectly understandable in a tightly supervised bureaucracy like the church, it is hard to present the statement as an official position of either the church or the magazine on the values it wishes to teach, since an anonymous sub-editor is not the appropriate person to make a policy statement. It would also be helpful to know her definition of story. From the examples cited, they seem to be fiction in the sense that they are not based on historical events or have historical settings. Yet the friend has done superb series of scripturally based and historically based stories retold for a young audience. Presumably such stories were systematically excluded because they have to contain a given set of data, unlike presumably pure fiction, but we cannot be sure in listening to the analysis. This version of the study also does not identify any of the stories it discusses by author. Thus, we have no way of knowing if this random selection has more than one item by a given author. If someone were interested in following up in other words, we may run into six stories by the same person, and we may be dealing with a personal interest rather than a full-scale church value. For someone interested in following up on the study, full source citations would also be helpful. Another question I had is the dates of the study. Carey has selected three stories per year between 1948 and 1979, and six stories per year between 1979 and 1987. Obviously, this lets her study the incomplete decade of the 1980s in greater detail, but one of the greatest impacts on the friend occurred in 1971. In December 1970, along with the other magazines in the church, the Children's Friend ceased publication as an independent voice of the primary association, and the Friend began publication of the magazine for children under the Correlation Program. The editors and staff of the Friend were no longer supervised by nor employees of the primary, but of the church. Lucille Reading, the editor, continued under the new system. And because she had been called to that position by Harold B. Lee, not hired by the church personnel department, she was able to fend off a move by the supervising member of the Quorum of the 70 to retire her and replace her by a candidate of her choice. And the magazine continued to reflect probably different values because of that than it would have if he had been successful. Perhaps even more importantly, beginning in 1971, all of the stories and essays in the magazine had to then pass the scrutiny of the Church Child Correlation Committee. When I came to work for the Ensign in 1973, one of the classic encounters between the Friends staff and the Correlation Committee had already occurred. A story about a duck had been sent back from Correlation with a stern note in the margin beside a paragraph in which the duck, while diving, had emitted the sound glub glub. "Ducks," read the note, "do not say glub glub, they say quack quack." At least some members of the Child Correlation Committee also felt that the magazine could best reflect gospel truths by following a standard of strict literalism. And there was considerable tension for some time, as I understand it, over the issue of having stories in which animals appeared as thinking, talking characters. In other words, a whole new set of values was imported because of the supervisory aspect of the Correlation Committee. Thus, I suggest that knowing the watershed represented by the year 1971 not only helps identify the trends, but also the reasons for them. Yet the dividing point for the study was not 1971, but 1979. Another important line to develop in providing context for understanding the trends would be the history of the magazine's relationship to the primary association. For instance, the first issue of The Children's Friend appeared in January 1902, strictly as a newsletter for primary workers. It contained lessons for three grades and instructions for officers, but no stories, illustrations, games, or activities. The general authorities had specified as a condition for publication that the newsletter must stay out of debt. The president, Louis B. Felt, pledged her own home as collateral, and the next president, Mabee Anderson, left her work at the University of Utah to become the full-time editor. In other words, this was not a church-sponsored publication. This was a primary publication, and I don't know that you can make an exact and identical equation between the two at that time. During the teens, stories, poems, and simple illustrations were included, but it did not become strictly a children's magazine until 1961 under Laverne Parmley. In other words, for the first 12 years covered by Carey's study, this magazine had a dual audience, adults and children. Furthermore, for the first 22 years covered by the study, at least one of the magazine's purposes was to advance the goals of its sponsoring organization, the primary. What were those goals during this period? What was the relationship of the Children's Friend to curriculum in general? And since 1971, when the primary no longer had a voice in the Friend, what have been the major influences on the Friend outside the staff itself? Most of these questions go far beyond the scope of Carey's paper. It would have been neither possible nor desirable for her to attempt to cover some of these issues. But a complete understanding of the content that appears month by month in this sprightly, appealing publication depends on some of these answers, and perhaps someday someone will take up that challenge.
Yeah, I did a random sample, so there could be a lot there that I never saw.
That concludes the session.